and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nestle & Associates. Nestle & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. My name is Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm. And today I'm co-hosting with my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Jack Nestle, the founder of Nestle & Associates. The ERP Organizational Change Journal seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, to expand what we see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP and organizational change community. The primary purpose of this podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change. It's our sincere hope that this will be a collaboration tool and resource, and that we hope you will find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, explore best practices, and discover the human elements of ERP organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner experience of both project successes and failures. A general review of the theme of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that an understanding and critically an awareness of tactics founded in principle is fundamental to ERP organizational change success. We'll discuss these tactics, explore these approaches, and discover the principles that may be useful in addressing your ERP organizational change challenge and risks. We look forward to having you join us. Jack?
Hey, thank you, Jonathan. We are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk. Our guests include experts and pioneers in the field, which include organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. Our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success. I'm looking forward to another great conversation with Tim today.
Listeners, please note this is the second part of a two-part conversation. In this episode, part two, we will discuss the value of business intelligence, understanding and measuring operational issues with Mr. Tim Van Meegen. Mr. Van Meegen is a partner of the ProAction Group, an optional consulting firm which he co-founded in 1995. Tim has 30-plus years of experience helping middle-market companies identify, quantify, and mine latent value. He's widely recognized for his expertise in supply chain functions and as an author of the Implementing Supplier Partnership book. Known for presenting at national and local conferences and creating numerous articles on value creation, sourcing, and logistics. In addition, he created the firm's proprietary 9-box inventory and pricing tool, which has helped countless companies optimize their inventory levels and improve their pricing practices.
In this episode, we will explore and discuss some key business intelligence concepts, including data-driven decision-making, systems audit, process-driven leadership, key performance indicators, and innovatively incorporating technology. This episode will discuss how to turn data into insight that is actionable. Timely and accurate visibility to operational data is a significant competitive differentiator. We will discuss many people, processes, and technological influences that help ensure organizational business intelligence availability and alignment. We will explore more with Tim the challenge of strategic decision making. With that, let's continue our conversation with Tim.
So switching gears here, because a lot of this is predicated on making sure that we're measuring the right things. And KPIs, the key performance indicators, are very useful. Oftentimes when they're not there, they're the first thing I look for. And you have a few articles that talk about them. I actually want to get a different discussion going with you. The danger of KPIs is the same reason why they're useful in my view, because what you measure, you get. And especially with this model of the economy and businesses as a machine. What do you see as the danger with KPIs?
I love that question. And, you know, the first is to be careful what you ask for. That is the first one. And I believe that in a good company, every single person is going to have a number. They have something that they own within that company that if something goes on in that topic, they're the ones that are going to talk about it. It's a very powerful thing. But if you ask people for the wrong things, it can be very devastating. I once had a client that had in the past wanted to reduce scrap on a cardboard product they were making. And so they told everyone they were going to give them a bonus if they reduce scrap. Mm-hmm. And what they had been doing was buying standard width cardboard and slicing it to the size they needed. And somebody figured out, well, if I buy the width I need, I don't have to slice it and I won't have any scrap. Well, buying the width you need means I'm now buying multiple SKUs because I have to buy each width I'm going to need. And that's much more expensive than buying standard width cardboard. Mm. And so what ended up happening was that their inventory level shot up, their costs shot up, and on top of that, they had the benefit of paying people bonuses for that change.
Yep.
It was a poorly designed metric.
So this is so important here because part of human nature is to figure out how to benefit from a system in my experience of it. And so what happens is, as you clearly demonstrated, what was thought to be a useful reduction in cost on an individual or even a divisional level looked to be a major organizational cost.
Amen.
Yeah, I think like you were saying, Tim, in the answer to the previous question and to Jonathan's point, is one of the main dangers with KPIs is making the wrong assumptions, right? And that's why that conversation with the people beforehand and really understanding KPIs and metrics and how and why they're using them is a critical part of developing KPIs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tim, a little follow-up here. I want to ask you because KPIs often aren't the things we're actually looking for. The map versus the territory idea here. KPI is, in some cases, the best proxy for what we're looking for. So what's the risk in selecting a proxy? Regardless if we choose the right or the wrong one, what's the risk that we start to view that proxy as a full replacement for the territory in lean manufacturing?
Yes. If I'm following the question correctly, you can't measure, tell me if this is the question, we can't measure exactly what we're trying to do. So we get a proxy, and then people kind of view that as the goal.
Sure.
As opposed to a proxy for the goal. Yeah.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think there's a couple of things, and this maybe I'll tie it back to the dangers of KPIs in general. What our real goal here is to align behavior with the strategy of the company and to give people good, clear feedback of when they need to adjust, processes, approaches, behavior. And so if we use a proxy and it becomes an opportunity then for people to sub-optimize, you know, for their department or what have you, then it becomes a problem. Like scoring the most points in a football game or scoring a lot of points in a football game seems like it's a great proxy for winning the game. But if you don't have the defense to actually keep the other side from scoring, that doesn't give you what you need. So there is a limiting factor to the use of a proxy. The other thing related to that too is that idea of really understanding the problem and diving in deeper. There's another great Einstein quote where he said, we should make everything as simple as possible, but no simpler. And if we use a proxy that gets us kind of closer in the direction of what we're trying to get to, but it oversimplifies it, then it becomes terribly dysfunctional. There's another one too that I've seen. There's a great metric in manufacturing companies that tracks the use of your total capacity. It's called OEE, overall equipment effectiveness. And it measures if you take the line speed that you're supposed to run, the 24 hours in a day, 100% first pass yield, and uptime, that it's always available to run. Okay. That provides you sort of like your universe of what you can accomplish. And 85% is considered world-class and the best and the highest performing companies. Any number can be good, though, based on the circumstances that the company is going through. But what we also see is that people start to try to interpret. And they'll say, you know what, I just want to measure it when we're running. And when, as that happens, it becomes like two people, then it's that definition of what does this actually mean? Or another one is when people measure on time delivery, is understanding the definition of what we're measuring. Because some people will say, well, if we agree to place an order, you know, this is when we said we're going to ship it. And if we ship it, then we're on time. But if the customer actually requested it earlier, that may or may not be incorporated into that. Was it shipped complete and full? Was it shipped in one shipment or multiple? And was it shipped correctly? Did we ship the right product? If we don't have clarity on what's actually being tracked and measured, it can lead to very bad decisions.
Absolutely. Okay, so Tim, I just want to share a quote with our listeners from a ProAction article in which I believe you were the author of the article, and you'd mentioned, quote, "Knowledge is power. In the area of limited benchmarking, Alexander was, in many ways, best in class," and referring to Alexander the Great. "He could not always follow a similar organization's pattern of success, but could instead rely on his knowledge-based intuition. Benchmarking, while a good tool to use, is not reliable when developing innovative solutions," end quote. Here's a challenge question for you in one sentence or less.
Sure.
Why do you make this statement?
For a couple of reasons. Here it is in a nutshell, though. If you're benchmarking to develop your plans, you're limited to performance that's already been demonstrated by others. That's the first piece right there. You will never break through to undemonstrated levels of performance if you rely on benchmarking. Benchmarking to me should be used on the other end. If I'm not doing better than what other people are doing, then that's a problem I need to look at. But benchmarking to say, where should I be, is not effective for that reason, okay?
That's so
There's
powerful.
Another pro-
that's
yeah,
incredibly
it is.
Powerful. It-
There's a couple of other offshoots of that too. One is that the problem with metaphors or benchmarks is people often focus on what the difference in their story is versus what was reported. A benchmark will be discounted when their situation is different. So not only are we limited to demonstrated performance, what I've seen be very common is people will then discount that benchmark because of differences in the examples or in the benchmark versus our company. And you know, the power of dissecting your own data using, you know, the lean manufacturing process to say, what does a waste-free system look like is much more effective in designing our future and making it possible to get breakthrough results.
Interesting.
So the in terms of applying and using current technology, if it not properly utilized, it can really drain and distract the company. And I'll start with one that's kind of obvious and near to your heart, which is ERP systems are a great example. What we find is many companies do not use their current system, whatever it is, well or thoroughly.
Sure. Yeah.
They have poor data hygiene. Mm. They do not nurture a problem-solving culture. And then their idea is to spend millions of dollars and years to implement a more expensive system that they will not use.
Exactly.
What, right? So first, before going down that path, we have to put the habits in to have good data hygiene. Teach the company of how to do a plan, do, check, act, problem-solving culture. Then a system will be relevant for them. And that's an example. Another one is automation. People often will come in and ask us to evaluate their automation, and they think we're going to come in and tell them to automate more. Mm. Automation is great for companies that have longer runs and fewer items that they make. Automation often requires longer setups and a lot of maintenance. But at the end of the day, good old-fashioned work balancing, lean manufacturing, good accountability, and improved layouts drive many improvements that don't have CapEx. And companies, we work with boards of directors all the time who've been asked by their management team for more CapEx to put in new equipment. And we spend a bit of time to find out that they're not using what they have today. So that in general, the pursuit of new technology, whether it's related to the systems or related to equipment, is not, it's not the right question.
Mm.
It's not the problem. It's not, it may be a problem, but it's not the problem.
Tim, I'm so glad we had this conversation. The key here that I want our listeners to understand is there's a difference, it sounds like, between the effectiveness that you're getting out of your current system versus what you think you need to play at right. a totally different level. And often it sounds like from the scope of this conversation, we're not really sure we're measuring that data correctly. And we're probably being right. pretty selective on what data we want. And all of that is probably a great segue to talk about your 9-box model and how you actually sure. help companies see this. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's a great tool, very powerful, and it allows us to take a great amount of data, which is like sales history and inventory balances, and boil it down to one page and segment a company's business to highlight a few things. So I'll give you a quick example. A very common version of the 9-box that we use is to show the traditional ABC SKU segmentation. So A is your top, the 80% of your cost of goods sold, the Bs are the next 15, and Cs are the last 5. We add to that on the other axis going across the top, low volatility items, medium, and high volatility items. And what this allows us to do is to look at a company sales that are, relatively speaking, high volume and low volatility versus those that are low volume and high volatility. And the best outcomes of doing this analysis that came out of it was realizing many companies say, oh, we're a high volume, low SKU company, or we're low volume and high SKU. Here's the reality. Every company's both. They have items that are high volume and low volatility and the vice versa, but they try to run them all the same way. And they require two different approaches. If you've got something that's high value, a high volume, and it's low volatility, I want to watch that stuff every single day because it's big dollars and it's manageable. And I want to manage it so I have 1 or 2 days of inventory, relatively speaking, low dollars. And the rest of it, we set it up in, we have rules, you know, and triggers that allow us to manage to make sure we don't run out and that we don't end up with 2 years of inventory either.
Sure.
We had one client that was so helpful for, remember starting the project, and I asked the CEO, what keeps you up at night? And he said, you know, 3 years ago, before we took on the investment from our new private equity partner, I had 300 SKUs, and I could manage that, and it worked great. Because now I have 3,000 SKUs, and every single day, some customer's yelling me about something I don't have in stock, and I can't get ahead of it. I'm really frustrated. We did the 9-box, and here's what we found. 87% of their profit came from 6% of their SKUs, sold to about 6% of their customers. And when we showed them that, we said, look, all your planners are going to spend all their time on that 6% of your SKUs.
Yeah.
And they're going to make sure that you never run out and that you don't have too much. And everything else, and I'm going to oversimplify it, we're going to put 2 months of stock in the shelves. But guess what? It's 13% of your dollars. It doesn't matter. Have 2 months. It doesn't matter. And that way you never run out. And our people are spending their time where the dollars are. That's one of the, probably the single biggest insight that comes from the 9-box. You know, we need to manage each part of our company differently. And real quick, right. the other big side of it is looking at pricing. Another way we do the 9-box is we have the volume, so the AB SKU on the SKUs, and then across the top, instead of volatility, we do it for large, medium, and small customers. And we look at the margins that they charge in each of those, and you would typically expect to see margins go up as the customer size goes down, and as the SKU size goes down, the margins should go up. In addition, we talked about that volatility 9-box. As volatility goes up, your margins should go up. And when we don't see that pattern, it leads to great conversations. Why isn't this going up? Often it's a lack of discipline where people in sales are not following the pricing strategies that were laid out.
Right.
But there are times where it makes sense. We had one client that the owner of the company was involved in all the sales to their A customer, and he was very good at pricing things to make money, and he didn't care about the other items. Like, you know, it's a small percentage. He didn't look at it. And it was not the salespeople's fault at all or anything like it. It was just how the leader thought about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Tim, you know, we both know that inventory is just one example where mid-market manufacturing firms have operational blind spots, right, that can severely impact EBITDA and enterprise value. So really, it seems to me like the primary reason you developed the 9-box framework is so that you can turn, you know, the organizational data into new insight and remove those blind spots from this strategic decision-making process. Tim, you know, I think that you and I are both strong advocates for effective dashboards. Notice I didn't just say dashboards, but effective dashboards.
Right.
And I know that you also teach the value of watching for the dashboard trap. Can you explain what you mean by this to our listeners? What is this dashboard trap that you refer to?
Yes, I'll put it this way, and then a couple of ways to avoid the problem. So there are times that people will put together a dashboard and it does have proxies and I'll say sub-optimized metrics that can make parts of the business look good without telling the whole story. And it doesn't lead to change, okay? But they feel like, hey, we checked the box, we've got the metrics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it leads them to become kind of complacent in a way. A few things that we found, though, that help to avoid that situation. And the first one, and we've talked about a little bit, is to do a good job in designing the dashboard and the metrics you put on it. And one good way I've heard about is to track the few, the powerful. So for each different part of the company, so you're going to have a board level set of metrics and you'll have operating metrics, sales metrics, what have you. For each one, what are the one or two things that matter at that level of the company and measure those and push other metrics to more detailed or specific dashboards. So you don't lose sight of the picture of the story that's being told by the dashboard and the data. The second one is, it's much more common companies will have leading indicators on their dashboard. So things like EBITDA, sales level, or sales growth. These are outcomes of all of our processes. And those are good to measure and good to look at and tells you how effective you've been in the past. The lagging indicators are the one, I got these terms mixed up. Those were the lagging indicators. The leading indicators are the ones that tell you how you will perform in the future. These are things like cycle times, internal quality, employee engagement, morale levels, employee safety that allow you to look at the components of a healthy business, but it doesn't show up necessarily on the income statement as something you would go and talk about with the bank. And those leading indicators help people to understand when they're going to be successful and what they need to change, when something's not optimized, so to speak. And then the last piece, which gets back to one of the ways that Jonathan kicked off this discussion, is the human piece. For a dashboard to mean anything, you have to do what one we call it a Gemba walk, whether it's virtual or literal, but you need to walk the plant where they have the metrics and look and see how is it working? How is the plant running? How's the line running? How are the people doing? And actually see it. You go to where the work is being done and you make observations. You talk to people. You view metrics as a conversation starter, not a conclusion. And that is where the rubber meets the road. That's where you actually start to make change happen and people view metrics not as an opportunity for them to get in trouble, but rather data that enriches a problem-solving, you know, activity where they get to think about and say, oh, I know how to fix this. I know how to make this better. It's very exciting and
right.
Such a different way of looking at it.
Tim, again, I find myself nodding my head here, right? Especially that KPIs become the starting point of the conversation rather than a potential for punishment. And from a change perspective, I'm amazed by what happens in a company when you switch the conversation from blame to inquiry. Yeah. And I think you've got a really counterintuitive process to help do that from this conversation. We're starting to wind down this conversation here, and I want to help fellow practitioners who are probably listening to this podcast think about what they can do to identify and help companies bridge this gap. Because many companies probably are sitting here with multiple systems, different pieces being managed by different people in different areas. And as you mentioned earlier, the definitions they may be working with might be very different, even if they're saying the same thing. So with all your experience, what would you advise practitioners to look for, to see, and to act on in order to help resolve this?
Yeah, I love this question, and it makes me think of that old, you know, metaphor of the frog in a pot of water, and you turn up the heat and it'll never jump out because the temperature rises so gradual they don't really notice it.
Yeah.
Right. And so we need to wake them up. And so the first part, and you mentioned it, is what do you look for? The first thing, we have to be able to recognize that it's happening. So how do you know when this is a problem? Here's some examples of things that we've seen. We did a project like this to work on process reengineering, kind of lean out the front office for a company. And here's some of the things we found. Processes were different based on the division for the same task. So different groups of people were doing the same task in the same company, and they did it differently. Workers would get different direction depending on what executive they talked to. Managers had overlapping responsibilities and spent a lot of their time trying to work things out with colleagues. Okay. You had to dive in and talk to somebody about how they specifically handled the task because there was no clear standard way of doing it. And here's what I love about this, that people were responding to their world and doing the best they could. This was not a problem with anybody in the company. They were trying to do the best they could, but the way that the ownership had set it up, they had did not set up an effective system. They did not have alignment even on what their goals were for the company. There were a couple of different divisions that each division was, kind of sub-optimized. And so the first part was they wanted us to come in and help them correct a billing system. We said, the billing system is not the problem. The problem is that the data going into the billing system is dependent on who's working that day and on which project. And it's done differently. So they have to interpret every single project. It's so difficult. They spend so much time trying to understand it that we ended up going back to the owners and saying, and showing them this evidence. We walked them through the process. And actually, when this really became clear, is we actually had the entire management team and the people that did the work in the room together, and we walked through the whole process of the company, and people stood up and said, I had no idea you were doing that. If I knew that's how you were working, I would never do what I'm doing. I'm sorry for the trouble I've caused you. They had no idea. Okay. Wow. People want to do a good job. They really desperately want to do a good job.
Yeah.
And so the key here is that when you get in and you see the signs that there's not consistency, there's instability, there's different ways that things are being done, then that's when you get to escalate it and go back and talk to the owner and say, look, I'd love to do this project for you, but until you fix these or address these other things, all I'm going to be doing is, I'm going to be pushing a rope or reorganizing the deck chairs. It's not the problem. And it's a great opportunity. It's a wonderful thing when you get to see that and help them come to that realization. Give them a chance to change what's not working.
So true.
Tim, again, this is just incredible, right? The way I'm so glad that you gave that story, because the way I experienced that was the data was actually there to create a human conversation, and you actually made change on both the leadership and the employee side by providing that transparency and kindness and the data to justify the conversation, if I'm understanding you correctly.
No, you got it exactly right. When you put those two together, you know, there's a lot of tension in that company, and it takes the tension out when people realize, oh, you're not just trying to say I'm the problem. Once that becomes clear and you have then the data to show what it could be, it makes the rest of it go so smooth.
All right, Tim, last question of the interview. You and ProAction have been quite successful. And I know that you understand as well as anyone the value of properly managing the triad of people, processes, and technology when it comes to operational improvements. If you had to distill down your years of experience and your obvious insight and observations and your success, I'm going to challenge you here, but in three or four sentences, what last words of advice would you leave to our fellow colleagues and our listeners in terms of making organizations better through data? Any last words of advice?
Yes. You know, I'm thinking about this too, just in terms of their businesses and also how you can help your clients. The first thing that jumps out to me, this may not be exactly what you asked, but the first one is to define your core values. Okay, this is for you as your company and what you do and what you work on and how you work with your clients. Not your aspirational values, but those that actually define who you are and who your organization is today. And the reason I say that is because if you go in as a united front and you're thinking the same way, it's like a jazz band. And sometimes you get a group together and they jam. They play beautiful music because they're playing off each other and riffing off each other, and they've got a common, you know, view and set of values of what they're trying to accomplish. And that's the first thing. So when you go in, you know, the ego's gone and you've got a group that's really focused on the same thing, it drives a lot of beautiful things. Second, and this is very tied into what we've been talking about, is develop a number for every person in your company. Everyone should own a metric, from the CEO to the mailroom clerk. And whether this is your company or a client, it's helping everyone to define and understand their role and their goals with clarity. I found that to just be transformational when you think of it that way, as opposed to people just sort of gut feeling, you know, what they're doing well and what their goals are. Jonathan just brought up a minute ago, it's to demonstrate that metrics are data points, not conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the human side. Talk to people, go to where the work is done, and follow up on things that are either out of spec or puzzling. And it's more out of a sense of curiosity and a desire to, the better we understand the problem, then we're going to actually be able to solve it. That's the critical thing. I heard Einstein say one time, it's not that I'm brilliant, it's that I stick with the problem longer. I understand what the real problem is. Right. And the last to teach people how to solve problems. Make it part of the culture. Demonstrate on how, you know, to focus on the problems, not the people. And there's it's not just an art. You don't have to be a nice person to do it. It's a science. It's a skill. It can be worked on.
So it's interesting, Tim, because, you know, that last question, you know, we asked deliberately to kind of bring in that triad, the people, processes, and technology.
Yes.
But it seems to me one of the things I'm hearing throughout our entire conversation, almost with every question, actually, is this underlying theme or thread that is people, cohesion, and transparency is foundational, you know, like you said.
Yes.
And I think that if I had to summarize, especially your last comment, I think that's how I would summarize it, is process and technology is critical, but perhaps this people piece and the cohesion between the people and the transparency between the people is absolutely foundational for operational organizational change success.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, great, Tim. Thank you greatly for your time today. We really appreciate it. What an interesting conversation. I really wish, on behalf of Nestle & Associates and Jonathan and myself, we wish you and your team at ProAction the best and continued success. Thank you again and be well. We appreciate your time.
Total pleasure. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you for a great conversation, Tim.
Please join us in our next episode as we discuss effective organizational change with Dr. Eric Canny. Dr. Caney is a faculty member at the University of Southern California, Rossier School of Education. Dr. Caney is an educator, entrepreneur, producer, researcher, founding director, and chief innovation officer. Dr. Caney is founding director and chief innovation officer for the Global Risk Mitigation Foundation, a multidisciplinary business risk consultancy providing independent and objective risk assessments, compliance services, and cutting-edge risk management information. Dr. Caney is co-founder and producer of Genesis Films, a documentary film company focused on showcasing, quote, wicked problems around the world and solutions to them. The Genesis Media Foundation, leveraging media to enact change in education, human rights and immigration, environmental and food sustainability, as well as medical needs and rights. Please join us again next week.
We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of ERP and organizational change speakers, authors, professors, researchers, pioneers in the field, practitioners, PE partners, business executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, and if you feel so inclined, leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us again this week as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and three, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. Hashtag the ERP Organizational Change Journal. Have a fantastic week.
Bye for now.